Welcome into the Sports Objective Podcast, the original podcast and the unauthorized podcast of the Pirates. Got a big show tonight, and Bubba, Kyle, hey Kyle, what's up, dude?
What's going on, Dave? Good to be here on a Thursday night, about to watch a little Appalachian State, Arkansas State, and see what happens. The Mountaineers haven't played in 3 weeks.
I was getting ready to say, it's great for them to have just a game, man. It's great. Bubba Rosenbaum, what's up, dude?
Not much. Just like Kyle said, I'm about to check out App State and Arkansas State. Wish the Pirates were playing this weekend so we could build on the momentum we've developed against the USF and Navy. But hopefully next Friday we'll be here soon enough.
Well, I've got to do two things. I got to watch that game, but there's also this thing called a presidential debate that I kind of care about. So I've got to do two things at once. I think I'll have the big screen. We'll have the debate, and I'll have the laptop that I'm using right now for the game. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen,
the presidential debate, I don't mean you to interrupt you before you introduce DG, but the presidential debate, a.k.a. romper room.
I think we're going to bring our guest in, David Glenn, here. He hosted many years of David Glenn's show, and waiting for him to be back on radio. We'll talk to him about that. And by the way, folks, one of the publications that I absolutely love that he's part of, theathletic.com. They've been with us for the last 2 years because they came on with us. I subscribed 2 years ago, July of 2018. Every single day, it's like the old days of having a newspaper back when there was before it. Well, there's always been Associated Press, but now it seems like a lot of newspapers just subscribe to that. But they actually give you real journalism. And with us, David Glenn, how are you, man?
I'm doing great, Dave, and I'm having a lot of fun with The Athletic. That's a great model. Some people think it's going to be like the sports journalism model of the 21st century. We'll see. But we just passed 1 million subscribers at The Athletic. So yes. That's not a number that anybody can just shake a stick at. That's not easy to do in any form of journalism. So it's great to be with you guys again. And it's been a lot of fun continuing to get in more writing, even while I'm taking a little sabbatical on the terrestrial radio side of things.
How do you think The Athletic has grown so fast? Do you think it's because they've gone out and spent money and hired good people like David Glenn? Or you know, and I'm being serious. I'm not
in all seriousness. You know, Kyle, one of the reasons I said yes, I'll tell you guys something that I'm not sure I've shared publicly. 3 years ago, if you all know how the model is, there's The Athletic, kind of the main brand, and then there's just 50 plus different sub sites.
Right.
Okay. And about 3 or 4 years ago, they came to me and asked me to run The Athletic Carolina. While I was in the middle of the best, most successful job I had ever had, I was doing really well in every way. I loved my job. I was having fun with our statewide AM/FM audience and just doing a little writing. And I had to say no to that opportunity, but I agreed to be a freelancer. So as long as you guys don't mind if I write 5 times in 1 month, and one time in another month, if I'm crazy busy with my, you know, my regular job, count me in. And the reason I did it is because, I mean, some of the guys that I grew up watching and reading are now contributors to The Athletic. I mean, you know, some of my age colleagues, you know, Seth Davis, I knew back when he was at Duke. You know, he's their number one guy on college basketball. That's a pretty good start. And of course, dozens beyond him. So Joe Person on the Panthers, Sarah Sivian on the Hurricanes here in our part of the country. I'm a Philly guy originally, so I read The Athletic Philly, you know, just to catch up on the Eagles, who are actually playing tonight in the lowly NFC East. One more football game for us all to watch, maybe. But, yeah, I was attracted to the quality of writers, and I was attracted to the business model because basically in 1994, when I created ATCSports.com, it was a tiny miniature version of what The Athletic is doing right now on a worldwide basis. It was don't rely on advertising, bite the bullet, and hope people will plop down their, you know, whatever, $7 per month. I did this in 1994, and it's hard because we live in a world filled with free information, of course. If your writing is good enough, if your talent that you hire is good enough, 1 million subscribers certainly shows that they're resonating with a lot of people. You know, are they going to be the answer in the long run and profitable in the long run? Who knows? I had to worry about that with ACCSports.com because I owned it for a while. I'm happy to just be a contributor to The Athletic. Those guys have to worry about the long-term economics of it all, and it's tricky right now. Well, you guys have a podcast. Economics are tricky right now. So whether you're doing something on a worldwide scale in podcasting, writing, audio, you know, satellite radio, the world's weird right now, and the media world is extra weird right now. But, man, I am honored to still be a contributor to The Athletic and The Athletic Carolina, because I just like associating myself with people and companies that, you know, don't accept anything short of greatness. And that's what I think they do a pretty good job of delivering every day.
Not being a subscriber to The Athletic, Dave may know the answer to this before I ask you, DG, because he's a subscriber. Does The Athletic do any podcast or anything like that beyond just the written word?
They do. Now, I think 2 years ago, the answer to that was no. They had no audio, no video, and no advertising. So they were really going old school. I know that they're expanding their podcasts to a great degree. You know, there's an ACC-specific podcast right now, other conference-specific, sports-specific, team-specific podcasts. So, yeah, they're really branching out on that side right now.
Yeah, it's a, you know, DG, that's the one thing is that the way you're asking, I guess that Kyle was asking rather, how it makes it. I think that how your website looked in 1994 doesn't look the way that you know, it does now, even though I know you don't own it, but it's way different. You know, we can't keep things as much as we would like to, especially when you get older, you want things to stay the same. As much as we want things to stay the same, they have to evolve. And I think that's what The Athletic has realized, and there's other people in pirate land that have realized that podcasts are for real. And when we started 2.5 years ago, people were laughing. They're not laughing now. They're seeing that podcasting is a real medium. And now when we add streaming to the mix with our views and listens, not to be inside baseball, but it really is it's a medium that people, it's been around a long time, but I think the last 2 or 3 years has really got some traction. And I know, for example, you guys did an excellent job with the radio show, putting all 3 hours out.
Yeah.
And that was excellent for those of us that have to work for a living. You know, we have to work, so we can't always, but when I was working with you, David, at the same company, I could be sitting there at the cubicle listening to the David Glenn show, but I didn't have that luxury anymore. So it was nice to have that. But even if you have a radio show, you're still going to put out as a podcast, because those of us that work for a living, that's how we listen.
There's no doubt about it. And just to underline that, as I congratulate you guys on your progress over these 3 years, I have spent a big chunk of this year just exploring what I want to do next on the audio side. And there is, you know, a big company called SiriusXM. There's also, you know, The Athletic. I might go full time with The Athletic, and I might be 75% writer, 25% podcaster. We're kind of talking about the variations right now. But one other thing that I noticed, and Dave, this underlines what you said about just the reality of podcasting as part of the wave of the future. When companies like Apple and Amazon, and there's a third that I'm forgetting off the top of my head, when they within the last 12 months decided that they're getting into podcasting, anybody who rolls their eyes at podcasting better stop rolling their eyes, because I wish I could remember the third, but I mean, does it get much bigger than Apple and Amazon? And there's a third one that's just that size. They've decided to branch out into podcasting, and you know, they're already making some progress. So large, small, and in between, it is because people are busy and they want everything on demand. Everybody I know agrees that podcasting is more of a growth industry than even the AM and FM radio world, where, you know, if I was willing to take a 60% pay cut, I'd still have a statewide radio show right now. That's how bad the economic model is crumbling in sports radio. And when we left, one of our biggest affiliates lost 71% of their audience in the months that followed. Wow. So they're paying less, but the listeners crashed by 71%. Over a period of months. So, you know, who's winning there? Doesn't sound like the business is winning. Doesn't sound like the listener is winning. And that's why a lot of people believe terrestrial radio is on the decline, even in the sports context, as podcasting is clearly on the upswing.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to get too deep into the weeds or inside baseball, but the very fact that I told you a couple days ago that I really hope that maybe selfishly that I can hear you again, and obviously with the SiriusXM model, that's something that I know that a guy we had on the other night, you know very well, Chris Spatola.
Yeah.
But I just envision you on the ACC channel. And for folks that I know that everybody at SiriusXM watches, the big executives watch our podcast. but the very fact the ACC channel, they've got great people up there. But another one is that they need help with, and I'll be honest, is ESPNU Radio. I pray to God that they can get some more talent up there. And I love that channel. It's one of my favorite channels on there. But not that people care about what I listen to on SiriusXM, but I just said several times I've been driving down the road. I'm like, man, David Glenn could fit nicely right here. So now that we have you on, I wanted to say that publicly, because if people don't have SiriusXM, they really need to get it. It's good stuff, especially when the days of – you were talking about old formats and stuff. The days of listening to ACC basketball or listen to a basketball game and you're driving down the road, you listen to the AM station, and you don't know how the game ended. You hear it all the way up to the end of the game. And you don't know if your team won, did they lose, what happened. And so with SiriusXM, you never have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. During the pandemic, I've actually driven my wife's car a lot for various reasons. And my car didn't have satellite radio. So I've been introduced to this, you know, I knew what it was. I had heard it. But it's just the car that I use most often now during the pandemic. And so I've been fiddling around with, you know, not only the sports channels, but, you know, I've got like my Margaritaville Jimmy Buffett music channel. I think it's 24 on my system. I got this crazy hair metal music channel that I listen to once in a while. There's a No Shoes, like real chill, real chill country and sort of the intersection of lighter rock and country that I really like a lot, very relaxing. But yeah, it's I'm exploring all those places that you mentioned. I'm having a hard time finding the right economic model. I'll just leave it at that for
now. Okay. All right. Well, we want to talk, let's make a nice segue here to, if the David Glenn show were still going on, I can tell you one of the topics that you would be talking about, doing a nice job that you did covering East Carolina. Your son, is he a senior now there?
He is.
Yeah, I thought that. Okay, man, time is flying. I feel very old right now.
21. Can have a beer with his dad finally.
Wow, man, he was like what? I think he was 9 or 10 when I first met you. Well, anyway, so but the one topic that I know that you will be talking about is Holton Ahlers not being able to play. You knew we'd be talking about that tonight, I'm sure. But I think that, and I know the two guys how they feel about it. But I want to get your take, and then I'll let them join in on how you're a lawyer, and I understand that. I love Commissioner Resco dearly. He's one of my favorite people in sports, and I really sincerely mean that. But I'm just really disappointed that, I guess that's the best word I can use, since we're a family show, that we couldn't have, that he couldn't be retested, and a false positive meant he was out, even if it was a false positive.
Yeah, your frustration is shared by a lot of Pirate Nation, as you guys know. And I'll tell you one thing that I did in my legal career that applies here. When you decide as a conference that you're going to have a COVID policy, you truly sit around a table, or nowadays it might be a Zoom conference, and you say, okay, what do we know is going to happen? What might happen? And then you have to make rules that apply to these situations. You can't have a policy that does not address certainly the things that you know are going to happen. For example, a player testing positive. Well, what happens if the immediate tests after that are negative, especially in a world where the scientists can tell us, hey, X percent are going to be false positives. So Nick Saban at Alabama follows an SEC policy that, sure enough, it was a false positive. They had the right rules in place to address it. And by the time that Georgia game came up, he had been cleared to coach. The same thing should have happened with Holton Ahlers. And I watched every play of that game, and there's no doubt in my mind that with average quarterback play, just average, not even Holton Ahlers great, but just average quarterback play, the Pirates would have had their second straight win. They would have beaten Navy, and their season would have taken on a different kind of tone. Instead, He has to sit even while healthy because the AAC did not do a smart, thorough job of writing their rules in an intelligent way. And that comes back to bite the Pirates in the rump.
Yeah. And to kind of echo that, Dave, when you have a rule in place, because the SEC initially had the same rules and then they changed them. They made an addendum. And when you see that happen, you got to kind of keep up with the Joneses. You got to go, okay, well, the SEC, whoever has made a rule change, that's something we probably should address. And then you have it in place because it's inevitably going to happen. It's like you said, there's going to be a false positive. And in this case, it didn't happen to be, you know, you're even a starting offensive lineman or a starting linebacker, or it was your quarterback. And, you know, it literally, like you said, it cost us the ball game. And, you know, I've talked to several people, and this is not a knock on Mason Garcia. Mason Garcia is a freshman. He's a fine young man. He's very talented. He's a puppy with big paws.
Yep.
But what has happened over the last couple of weeks is we got a young running back named Raji Harris, who's came in and started playing against South Florida. He wasn't starting that game. He came in off the bench. And we discovered who our bell cow running back is, and he ran the ball down South Florida's throat. Well, same thing against Navy. He ran the ball down their throat. Now, what that does, and in any offense, the run's going to make the pass better. But in this offense in particular, our passing game is predicated off the run big time. Now, what you saw against South Florida, when we could run the ball, Holt Naylor suddenly looked like a good quarterback. And the same thing would have happened against Navy. Holton would have had a lot in the passing game because they were concentrating on trying to stop that running game with Harris. Mason Garcia just had no confidence in his ability at all. He wasn't ready to run the offense. He couldn't make the reads. He hadn't progressed far enough along. And he made some plays with his legs, but as far as a passing game, he was so scared he was going to throw an interception that, you know, he didn't have any confidence in his ability, and I don't really think the coaching staff trusted him in the passing game to allow him to attempt very many throws. And it's like you said, if Holton would have just went out there and had an average game, if we'd have just had any kind of passing game, we would have beaten Navy. I personally believe with the way we were able to run the ball and the way Navy was bringing down safeties in the middle of the field, I think we would have had a lot in the passing game. Or they wouldn't have been able to bring those safeties down because they knew Holton was out there, and then we'd have had even more in the running game. I think we'd have dropped between 40 and 50 points on Navy and be celebrating a huge win. If you know how bad historically Navy has owned East Carolina, and be 2-2 on the season and riding high and ready to build a statue to Coach Houston because as bad as we've been here lately, you know, with the only conference team we've been able to beat in is Connecticut, and they left the league. So if we'd have managed to beat South Florida and Navy back-to-back, things would be electric right now in Greenville. And they're still, even after one win and a near miss, they're still pretty optimistic.
As they should be. And the long-term future for Mason Garcia remains bright. But he was a deer in the headlights against Navy on passing plays. That's just a blunt, honest way to put it. He was not ready to throw the ball at the college level. That's not the coach's fault. That's not even his fault. He's a freshman. I mean, yep. I know him well, his background well enough to know that at least two ACC schools offered him scholarships. I'm pretty sure Pitt and Syracuse followed him in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And to Mike Houston's credit, you know, he's kind of trying to build especially this three-state area of recruiting, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. Harris, the stud running back, is from the most successful high school program in South Carolina, Burns High. So he was a really good player there, kind of waited his turn, and then was the stud as a senior. So to Mike Houston's credit, the Pirates sign him out of the Palmetto State. And they get the 6'5", 240-pound, long-term promising QB. But he's just a baby, as you said. He's just a kid. He's got those big paws, and he's not ready to strut his stuff yet. So it's a shame how it unfolded. A missed opportunity for sure, a missed victory in all likelihood. And we can all look forward to seeing Holt Naylor's in the short term when he gets back. And then, you know, at some point, it's going to be fun to watch Mark Mason Garcia play quarterback for ECU.
Yeah. And
that's the beautiful thing is that, I'm sorry, Kyle, I was just going to quickly interject that I know that personally that you have a situation where Houston has said they set a quarterback for like the next 7 years and maybe eight, because now I want to get you another thing I want to make sure I talk to you about tonight, because you're Mr. NCAA when it comes to rulings and stuff. What are your thoughts on giving the players an extra year? How do you feel about that? Because there's a double side coin. It's great to get the extra year, but financially with East Carolina situation, I'm really worried about. That's something we're going to talk about later on. Is they furloughed people this week? There's been layoffs. Lots of problems as far as having money coming in. A lot of that comes from bad decisions over the last 7 years. Plus, we are not winning. And that's part of the bad decisions over the last 7 years. So we're right now in a situation where I'm worried with basketball, baseball, and football, but basketball and football especially, how can you afford to have those players? And then you got to – something else I want to talk to you about tonight is recruiting. You've got guys coming in. Can you – are you going to be able to please them, not only financially, but can you please all these guys that the world we live in where they transfer every 5 minutes?
It's tricky. It's not easy. There are no simple answers. Generally speaking, I try to be very pro-athlete. You know, the schools, when things are going well, reap the benefits and the profits and the big revenues. And, yes, players get room, board, tuition, cost of education adjustment, but especially the best players in the biggest sports, you know, still are not quite getting a fair trade. So I think my instinct when, let's say, last basketball season, when they get 90% of a season and only the NCAA tournament really and maybe the conference tournaments were taken away, in that scenario, I don't see how that's not a full year used. I'm a little hesitant as for reasons you suggested, Dave. I mean, I'm a business owner, so I can identify with athletic directors and university presidents who have to make these difficult decisions. I'm okay with giving those players through these bizarre circumstances an extra year of eligibility. But if they actually do play 10 to 12 football games or fill in the blanks for a different sport, that's, to me, close enough to a full season that it should count as a season of eligibility. I wouldn't feel bad when you get almost all of the experience of a season that it should be counted against you. Now, you know, there are sports last year where they didn't have any season at all. Of course, you don't take a season – you don't take a year away from those folks, and that does result in the scholarship logjam. Well, how are we going to fit under these scholarship limits all these guys who, you know, now have a new year of eligibility with all these incoming freshmen? It's a headache. It's complicated. The NCAA has the ability to get around some of these scholarship caps if they need to, but there are certainly no perfect answers where every athlete gets treated fairly, but then every athletic director can pay his or her bills.
Dave, they already have said in football that everybody's going to get another year of eligibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do have scholarship limits. They're going to have to raise them because theoretically it's not going to happen. But theoretically, you know, every senior at a school could choose to come back next year.
Yep.
And then you got to be able to bring in your incoming freshman that you've already offered. So you're going to have to raise the scholarship limit. There's no two ways about it. And when you take a school like East Carolina that's having budget problems right now, we can't afford to put 110 kids on scholarship for football. I mean, not right now, not with the problems we're having. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this is going to play out. Some kids are probably going to be told, hey, look, you got another year of eligibility left, but thanks for coming. See if you can go play somewhere else. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. To me, it's a good thing for the coaches. It's a good thing for the players, for the administration. It's a nightmare.
You are absolutely right. They probably made that announcement too quickly. Kind of like the Big Ten and the Pac-12 jumped the gun on the whole season decision. They, instead of kicking the can down the road as science evolved and new information became available and testing got better and other things changed over 4 weeks, they pulled the trigger too early. I think the NCAA might have been a little bit quick on the trigger by giving everybody that year of eligibility. I would have been in favor if any young person didn't want to play because of COVID and they wouldn't have to show any kind of special doctor's note. Just you can opt out of the season and it will not count against your NCAA clock. Your 5 years to play for. That I'm totally in favor of, just in case anybody for whatever reason wants to opt out. But yeah, I mean, giving everybody the extra year was probably a little generous. And, you know, they were reacting to public pressure in some ways. But I certainly know that a lot of athletic directors would like that decision back.
One of the questions that comes up, too, obviously, is how are your feelings about the transfer? I know that you're Mr. NCAA again, and I have to ask a few NCAA questions. As far as the transfer rule, I think they're going to be voting on that. How do you feel about that?
Again, no perfect answer. I break the tie in favor of the student. I would give every athlete in every sport the ability to transfer one time in a five-year period without any penalty. You don't have to come up with that, you know, excuse that you're moving closer to grandmom who's sick to be immediately eligible. There's so much nonsense with some of these immediate waivers and exceptions to the rules. I know the compliance people. I know how they're sort of bending the truth like pretzels to try to fit the reality so that somebody gets an exception. I know how college fans like to see their players evolve over 4 or 5 years. I get it. I enjoy seeing those stories as well. But given the structure of the system, I want to give those young people as much freedom as possible. And if they feel the need to move once, I think they should be able to do so without penalty.
You don't think it'll become a hot mess? I mean, in basketball, you know, it transfers and it's becoming an epidemic.
It's already a mess.
Exactly. It's already an epidemic. That's what I fear in football. You know, baseball maybe too, but particularly football, if you don't have to sit out at all. I mean, what scares me about this rule being in East Carolina, I'll give you an example, Rodgy Harris. Suddenly, maybe the Gamecocks want him now, or Clemson, or Georgia, and to me, that's not fair. So, you know, I don't like that at all for those very reasons.
And by the way, before and Kyle, just to let you know, there was a Twitter, there was actually a tweet out by him with a video. His name is pronounced Rajay. So I just want to let you know, he might transfer because you're not pronouncing his name right.
You know what? In ECU's game notes, it says Raji.
I know. Yeah, exactly.
That's Rajay.
Have they corrected it?
All right, I'm just going to call him Harris.
Yes. Mr. Harris. Given the way he's running, I'll call him Mr. Harris.
That's right.
So my point is, I would hate to see Mr. Harris end up a Gamecock or a Tiger or Bulldog, or you get the point. I mean, I think for each school it's a little different, but I think for your group of five programs, I think that becomes a real issue.
There's a downside no matter which way you do it, and there's a couple of downsides if you do allow those more free transfers. That's one of them. Now, there are NCAA rules in place that prevent technically, you know, the recruiting of the ECU athlete by Georgia or Clemson or anybody else. You know, the athlete has to put his name into a transfer portal before he's allowed to be contacted. But we all know stuff can happen through third parties where you whisper in somebody's ear, and then the next thing you know, somebody puts his name into the transfer portal and ends up at the school that theoretically had not yet contacted him. And really, of course, you know, the farther down the ladder you are, the more vulnerable you are to being poached. Right. Let's say you develop a quarterback over 3 years. This already happens with the grad transfer rule. Somebody develops a quarterback for 3 or 4 years and he wants a bigger stage as a senior. You know, he ended up not playing at Georgia, but Jamie Newman was turned into an NFL prospect by Dave Clawson at Wake Forest. There's no doubt about it. He was a relatively unheralded recruit. He became an NFL caliber prospect because of what he learned at Wake Forest. And because of the grad transfer rule, he went to Georgia. Again, he ended up opting out of the season, so it didn't quite unfold that way. Is that fair to Wake Forest? No. But, you know, you either have to be unfair to Wake Forest or unfair to ECU, or you have to tell, you know, young people that in a system that is not always fair to them, you know, we're going to come up with another rule that makes things harder on you. And that's, I probably would have felt differently when I started covering college sports a long time ago, but I've come to believe, given the billions of dollars in play, that when you have to break these ties, you should break them in favor of the athlete's freedom, even if they sometimes make dumb decisions.
But with the grad transfer thing, I've always looked at that differently, because you've graduated, you finished your degree. Why should you have to sit around somewhere you finished your degree at? So you've gone through what you were supposed to do. You fulfilled your commitments. You graduated. You have your degree. For instance, East Carolina, Kirk Benkirk, a couple of years ago, graduated as a junior. Still had 2 years of eligibility left and didn't want to deal with the nonsense known as Scotty Montgomery and decided he was going to go finish his career at Virginia. And I think he should have that freedom because he graduated. So to me, I mean, not to just be argumentative or anything, but to me, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah, I guess it's hard for me to justify a world where if you're the coach making $1 million a year, you're allowed to leave. But the guy who's getting room, board, tuition, and cost of education, you know, because of a rule, he's not allowed to leave. That's a little hard for me to justify because it shows the imbalance of the system and the unfairness of the system. You know, that coach had a lot of freedom. And he wasn't tethered to a school unless he signed a contract that made him pay buyout money if he wanted to leave, right? You know, good old-fashioned American freedom and capitalism. He got all of those freedoms exercised as he negotiated that deal and those terms and those departure details. There is no such power structure that favors the student-athlete, and that's why I just break the tie in a different direction. But I get why you feel the other way.
We've got hey, David, we have actually tonight one of our favorites, Pirate Al, that goes way back with us, obviously, not only our show, but the days of Coach Logan, the Coach Logan radio show. Can we put that up on the screen, Bubba? He has a question for DG. So we'll see what DG has to say about this. If you can put that up on the screen when you can. But Alan is, he comes on the show sometimes, a really knowledgeable fan. Graduate of ECU and a really good guy.
Let me just read the question, Dave.
He said, ask David who wins between Chief J Strongbow and Barry McGill in a steel cage.
That's really good. I'm going with Chief J Strongbow. I do remember Baron Miguel Cicluna. But I think Chief J, you know, when he gets mad, I don't know if you guys have ever seen him, probably the late Chief J Strongbow by this point. But when he got mad, he kind of went on his personal Native American war path. And let's just say you're going to be seeing and feeling a lot of his thighs, his knees, and his elbows in all the wrong places. So give me Chief J Strongbow in that matchup.
We got to go. Yeah, greatest Native American wrestlers, Chief J Strongbow to me, does not compare to Wahoo McDaniels.
Yeah.
Wahoo is a legend in the Mid-Atlantic area, but nothing against Chief J Strongbow.
As long as we're going wrestlers from the islands, give me the Wild Samoans. Remember, those guys are one of the greatest tag teams of all time.
Oh, sure, and their legacy still lives on through guys like Roman Reigns.
Yeah.
But if we're talking Native American guys, another one from Lumberton, North Carolina, a little bit later, WWE, WWF, late 80s, early 90s, the Native American Tatanka.
Oh, yeah.
Tatanka, yeah.
Wow, I hadn't heard that name in a while.
That's good stuff.
yeah, the road, we were talking about it recently with Alan Powell, with Pirate Al, about the Road Warriors. It was Hawk that passed away, right?
Hawk passed away.
I know I said that one, yeah.
Yeah, Hawk passed several years ago. Had a drug addiction problem, and Animal unfortunately passed away about a month ago now.
So, now that we talked about that, DG, what do you think about when it comes down to the Pirates, the second half of the season? We had the rule that we'll have our next guest we're going to talk to in just a few minutes about coming up. We'll talk about the bowls, and we're happy to see the bowl season is going to happen. So we're doing that in the second half hour. But I wanted to ask you about the Pirates. They came out with a rule. This is my last NCAA rule that I promised I'll talk to you about tonight. We have a three-question rule. But anyway, when the NCAA said that they got rid of the wins. So it's basically like the North Carolina High School Athletic Association now. You can have a few wins, and you still make the playoffs, DG. Well, you make the bowls.
Oh, the rule where there's no more six requirement or
this year only. Yeah. There's no minimal win requirement to go to a bowl.
I guess what do the kids say in their text to me? Y O L O. You only live once. You know, It's a YOLO type thing because of the pandemic. I really think that a whole lot of rules that in other years would have been laughed out of the room when they were proposed, this year everybody's just saying, yeah, whatever. You know, because I do think if you kept the regular rule, and because so many schools are not playing the 12 games, many are not even going to get to 11, some are not even going to get to 10 because of cancellations.
East Carolina.
you're going to run out of bowl eligible teams under the old rules. Now, a couple bowls, I believe, have already said that they're not even going to play, so they don't need as many bowl eligible.
Just three. Hawaii, Birmingham, and the one out in San Fran. But you know what? There's two new bowls coming in this year. Boston, and Myrtle Beach.
I'm not offended by this, you know, once only type rule. It's almost like a Notre Dame fan who could be 100 years old and has seen 100 years of the Fighting Irish as an independent in football. And yet here they are for 1 year and 1 year only. Remember, the ACC is just like, all right, whatever. You know, just kind of for that 1 year. Obviously, you would not want to water it down and have it that way in all seasons. But bowls need teams to play. And I like when kids get opportunities for the swag and, you know, a little TV exposure. Who cares if it's a game that nobody watches or hardly anybody watches anyway? Let the kids have some fun. And as long as there are enough bowls that have mouths to feed, you know, you got to give them enough teams to qualify.
What I want to see is how it's going to be implemented. Are the conferences going to go, all right, let's say the American, because that's where East Carolina plays. All teams with winning records have to be chosen first, you know, before any of our teams can go.
Those rules exist in other leagues, so yeah, you could very easily do that.
You know, or like the Myrtle Beach Bowl, do they come up and go, you know, hey, Coastal Carolina's a 10-11 win team. They want a regional opponent. No ACC schools want to go. East Carolina, you got three wins. Come play Coastal, you know, in Myrtle Beach. You know, just for example. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, this is where commissioners make their money. Because, you know, sometimes you do inspire an actual rule being made. Like in the ACC, some of the smaller schools with smaller fan bases got tired of being shuffled down the ladder as bigger schools that had lesser seasons get picked year after year. So they came up with you can only go one loss down in the conference record. So you could, if you were your favorite bowl, you were the decision maker, you could pick the 5-3 team over the 6-2 team in conference play, but you couldn't go all the way down to the, you know, the 4-4 team over the 6-2 team. So that was one way the ACC adopted a rule to deal with these things. In a year like this, I mean, because it's a 1 year anomaly in all likelihood, I think a commissioner just has to kind of play that sort of puppet master. You know, if you don't make rules like the one I just described, you just try to make marriages. This bowl looks like a good fit for this team, and we hope you're not offended. It's like Evening at the Improv, you know, for comedians. Yeah. That's what it's going to be during bowl season.
Well, I'm going to make a pitch right now to the Myrtle Beach Bowl. No matter what the records are for the Pirates, if you invite the Pirates for the short 2-3 hour drive down to Myrtle Beach, I don't know what the percentage of fans that are going to be allowed into the stadium there in Conway is, but we'll pack it.
I got my pick for DG because you're ACC guy and you know the backstory, so I don't have to explain it. My pick, because I do like Kyle's pick, but I'll be different for this show. I'm going to pick East Carolina. It won't happen because they're going to have a great year. East Carolina, Virginia Tech, and the Military Bowl in Annapolis because of all the problems we had. And they don't want to play us with their wonderful athletic director. So I'm going East Carolina and Virginia Tech.
So. As there's creative wheels you have turning up there, Dave. That's a good, good call. But you're right. The Hokies are probably going to be too good this year. They're going to be a little higher in the pecking order. Who knows? Somebody's got to play Clemson in that ACC title game, right? There's still about a half a dozen candidates I asked for that.
Before we let you go, I want to get your first of all pick on I know the answer will be no on the first question. Can anybody be Clemson? No. Who's going to be in the ACC title game? And can you give me your final four for the playoff?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the boring answer, but no, nobody's going to beat Clemson, not in the ACC title game. I do think that Notre Dame is the most likely team to face the Tigers. Irish have to play the Tigers in the regular season, so that's a likely loss right there. But I think a two-loss team is going to end up facing the Tigers. I mean, two losses in conference play. I think the Tar Heels are a nice, interesting team. The Wolfpack's a nice, interesting team. So is Virginia Tech. So is Notre Dame. So is Miami. But I don't think any of them is close to great. So they might be 6-2. If you can get to 6-2, you might be playing the Tigers for the ACC title. In terms of nationally, you know, having just watched Alabama and Georgia play, I could see both of them making it. Clemson is going to make it. And probably Ohio State out of the Big Ten is going to make it, even though we haven't seen the Buckeyes play yet. I just know the ACC from top to bottom. And, guys, I'm not exaggerating when I say the gap from Clemson at number one to whomever you think is number two, and we could debate that, there might be a half dozen candidates. That gap is similar from, like, just the grouping of 2 through 8, you know, that stretch. And I think the gap between those mega programs, maybe they stub their toes, maybe not. Alabama is as good as I've seen Alabama in a while. Clemson is as good as they've been under Dabo. So those two are going to be there. We'll see about the Buckeyes. We'll see about the fourth team. But I just don't see anybody in our neighborhood who's good enough to run the table. Somebody will get in with one loss, but Alabama and Clemson are going to be there, and I don't see anybody that I've watched that looks like a Georgia does, for example. So it might be the same old, which gets fans upset, but probably also provides for the best matchups in the semifinals.
DJ, one more question for me, ACC related. Not that I think they're going to be in the ACC title game, but how about the job Norvell's doing? From game one until last week, Florida State has improved dramatically.
No doubt about it. And that's a program that Kirk Herbstreit of ABC and ESPN said had a culture problem where all those guys that you signed on the recruiting trail, it was Jimbo Fisher signing them 4 years ago. It was Willie Taggart these last 2 years, then Mike Norvell this year. When you recruit on the premise, we're going to help you get to the NFL. When your season is going well, as it usually did under Bobby Bowden and usually did even until the end under Jimbo Fisher, guys are sticking their necks on the line. They're putting their face in the fan, the way coaches like to say. They're playing unselfishly for each other. They're putting good plays on video, et cetera. When it takes a downturn, as it did at the end for Jimbo, both years under Willie Taggart and at the beginning under Mike Norvell, guys start playing selfish. They start protecting their bodies, protecting their NFL status. It is on video, as Herbstreit pointed out a couple times. For Norvell in that culture to have a slow start to this season and then keep a locker room together so that they shocked a lot of people. I can't say that I was totally stunned, to be honest, because Carolina is not great on defense and Florida State finally found its quarterback. So it's partially credit to Mike Norvell. You guys saw what he did at Memphis. It's partially, you know, your third time was the charm. James Blackman was a turnover machine veteran quarterback. They tried a freshman named Tate Rodemaker, and some thought Jordan Travis was just this scat back guy who couldn't really throw the ball. Well, he's better than that. And when any locker room starts believing in a quarterback, they start changing how they believe they can win or beat a top five ranked Carolina team. So yeah, the Seminoles aren't going to be great this year. They're not very good on defense, but they have found life. They got a signature victory, and definitely Mike Norvell and his staff deserve credit for keeping that locker room together in a way that frankly, Willie Taggart was unable to do for his two full seasons.
And DG, one final question. I promise there's a big matchup on Tobacco Road that you know extremely well. Two programs doing well. I'm trying to remember the last time they were ranked. You know that answer, I'm sure. Yeah. That both teams are ranked, but Dave Doran and you have Mack Brown coming back doing a nice job, which we knew he would. Who wins on Saturday? We'll put you on the spot.
Yeah, I'll take the Tar Heels. That offense, I still think the defense is gettable. So maybe that offers the Wolfpack as the visitor, you know, some hope. No Devin Leary for the Wolfpack matters a lot. they found their quarterback as well. Remember, they used three guys last year. Leary was unavailable early this season when the Wolfpack didn't look as good. He became available, but then he got hurt this past weekend, so he's not going to be in a Wolfpack uniform as those two teams get together. Sam Howell is the real deal at QB for the Tar Heels. They have two great running backs, two or more really good wide receivers. I saw Mac Brown swing the pendulum in this rivalry way, way back in his first tenure. He lost his first five games against the Wolfpack head-to-head, and then he won the next five before he left for Texas. So it's fun to see both in the national top 25 in the rankings. I just think the Tar Heel offense is going to be the decider, and Dave Doran will fall to 4-4 against the Tar Heels.
All right, we'll have to find out, and obviously we want to promote. I know you're the Athletic. Where can everybody find your work?
On Twitter, we're at David Glenn Show. Online, The Athletic Carolina. I still do some things with accsports.com, which I created way back in 1994. So for now, yeah, those to be continued. Where else you can find my work, but for now, those are the places to go.
And when you have the announcement, will you break it on the Sports Objective? So we have like these
I'm okay with that. I mean, hey, things are so weird right now, guys. The big announcement could be something of a non-sports variety. You know, I'm considering all options right now. I had 30 plus years in more traditional media, radio, writing, and otherwise. So we'll see.
David Glenn is our third presidential candidate.
Yeah, right. At this stage of my life, I can afford to be picky. So I hope I find the right fit in sports media, but if not, there's a couple of interesting opportunities that I have in politics, law, business, some of those things, you know, completely unrelated to sports.
All right, DG, I know no matter what you do, you'll excel. You'll do extremely well. I'm proud to call you my friend, and I appreciate the time, the visit tonight, and we look forward to having you back on during football season and basketball season. We're definitely going to have you back on. It's just around the corner.
Yeah. Dave, it's great to be with you. Great to see your face here on this platform. Kyle, good chatting with you again. Bubba, thanks for your work behind the scenes. And really, congratulations to you guys for what you've built over these last 3 years. I know what it's like to try to build something. So I can identify with the blood, sweat, and tears that go into such things. So keep up the good work. And you know I'm always only a phone call away.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. And good luck to you. And I know that whatever it is, it'll be great.
Thanks, man. Have a good one, my man. Appreciate your support always.
Yeah, man. All right, DG. Well, that was great with David Glenn. Kyle, I'll tell you what, we went a little bit long, but I love DG, so there's a lot of good stuff there. And, you know, one thing I will talk to you, Kyle, about is obviously the bowl season. And you brought up you actually have been the best bowl director for Myrtle Beach because you put Coastal Carolina – and you have East Carolina, and I was talking to Bubba pre-show. I hadn't had a chance to mention to you yet. Can you imagine if that happened, how many tickets the Pirates would sell?
Well, you know, how many tickets are they going to be allowed to sell? Obviously, yeah. If they have Coastal in a home game, they're going to pack it anyway. But I just, you know, Coastal's going to be bowling for sure. They may go undefeated. And they're in the top 25 right now. Who could believe that? But, you know, they're going to want a regional opponent, I would imagine, you know, if all possible. And, you know, can't play at us, conference opponent. ACC is not a tie-in for that bowl. So it would probably be us or Charlotte, because I think the American and Conference USA both have ties to that bowl if they want a regional opponent. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I don't think you're going to see a one-win East Carolina team in a bowl, no matter what the rules are. But if we're playing well at the end of the season, if we're 3-6, 4-5, something like that. I with the momentum, I could definitely see a bowl taking a East Carolina team because there will be teams in bowls with losing records this year.
Well, that was what you read my mind, Kyle. That was my next question. Would a 3-6 team or a 4-5 East Carolina team make it? Normally you say, Dave,
I think that's a 4-5. That would mean we won. I mean, we got one win right now. We got five wins, five games to go.
3 out of 5.
That means we won 3 out of our last 5, and that means we would have had some damn good wins. Look at our last 5 games. So yeah. If we're somehow 4-5, I think it would be a shame if we didn't get a bowl. To me, 4-5 is the equivalent of 6-6 this year playing a 9-game schedule. Yeah.
I mean, it has to be exactly. And you look at a situation where we are now, where that would be huge for the program. I wish. And then, Kyle, doesn't that stadium for the Myrtle Beach Bowl, Coastal Carolina, isn't that about 20,000?
It's 20 or 22, yeah, something like that. Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know how many people are allowed to go. I don't know what their attendance situation is down there. And it's a long time between now and then to talk about that. But, you know, that Dave, I don't know if you want to talk about this now before we go to our interview with the bowl chair commissioner. Did you want to talk about the budget now or later?
We'll try to do that afterwards, and we were going to talk a little bit about bowls and then pitch it to that, to the interview, and then whenever we're ready, and then we will come back. And I was planning on about 20 minutes with David, and that's my fault, but with DG. But anytime you can have DG on the show, it's great. But the bowl season has been something we've been worried about, for all three of us, and I know we're not the only ones for many different reasons. And what, selfishly, because, Kyle, you know, sentimentally, the bowl season and the bowl system is something near and dear to my heart, because I grew up in the era when there was only, back then, it was not that many bowls. And so when now that East Carolina has a chance to go to bowl, then the bowl season means even more to me. And I thought that when we're looking back at the springtime, I just didn't see a way that there could be bowls. So the fact that we have bowls now.
Yeah, and pretty much all except for three are going to be played. And, you know, like as we will talk with the bowl commissioner in a minute, and you know, there's not going to be anybody with any amount of wins can go. I do think the conferences will delegate and make sure that the teams with winning records are taken first. But you know, there's going to be some discussions out there. You know, you got the MAC playing, I think, 6 games. So right. are you telling me that let's say a 3-6 or a 4-5 East Carolina, if that happens, were you telling me that we're not just as deserving as a 3-3 MAC school? So, I mean, if things play out that way. So
in other words, don't play percentages.
Right. It's going to be interesting to see how everything plays out with this. But I will say it again, I guarantee you there's going to be some teams with losing records going to bowls this year.
It has to be. And you look at it, there's only the Hawaii Bowl. We'll talk about that in an interview coming up with Nick Carparelli. He's the executive director of the Bowl Association, and he's like the main dude for bowls.
Yeah,
the Kraft
Fight Hunger Bowl or whatever it's called.
Yeah, that's dumb.
That should be his actual title instead of executive director of the Football Bowl Association. Wouldn't you say the dude?
The dude for bowls.
Yeah, the dude for bowls. Yeah.
I was thinking about the Big Lebowski, and our thoughts and prayers. Speaking of the Big Lebowski, Jeff Bridges has lymphoma. He came out, I think it was a few days ago. So if you love that movie with the dudes, then keep that in mind. Guys, I tell you what, that I really believe, and maybe I'm crazy, and I know you think I'm ahead of myself, Kyle, but I really believe we have a shot at a bowl. And this year I just didn't see it. But if we can have 3 or 4 wins like we've been talking about, and then if you look at it, the thing that I'm happy about, I'll say this, the thing I'm happy about now is when you watch a Pirate game, and you guys, the three of us got a chance to see the game Saturday, we had a chance, and we should have won that game anyway, but we were in the game, right? Where in the past, we've gone from being god-awful, where we had no chance, to where now Coach Houston, we're climbing that ladder rung by rung by rung. And you see now where we have a chance. This season has shown me where now you feel that fire inside. You feel those competitive. Those guys are not quitting anymore like they did after the first quarter. When they're down 27-13 last week, that would have been all she wrote. It would have been a few more touchdowns from Navy, and we would only have 13 points. So the fact that we scored 10 more and that we fought and we had a chance to come back in that game, and should have won that game if we had Holt Naylor's, but that's a whole nother podcast, a whole nother show. But the fact that we're competitive now, we have a chance to win, means it a lot. I'll tell you what, Bubba and I, and obviously we had a chance, Bubba, to talk to Nick Carparelli. He's executive director of the Bowl Association. And also we had a chance to talk to him. And let's go to that interview from earlier this afternoon. Let's play that right now.
COVID-19 outbreak, and now we have a very special guest.
Yeah, some of the requirements to go to a bowl are certainly not there this year, and with everything that's going on with COVID-19. And right now, to discuss that and much more, we welcome in the Executive Director of the Football Bowl Association, Nick Corporelli. Nick, we appreciate your time.
Happy to be here, Bubba. Dave, looking forward to spending a few minutes with you.
Absolutely. I wanted to reach out to you because we've been debating that on our show here on the Sports Objective with the Pirates. East Carolina, they're under a rebuilding mode under Coach Mike Houston. How would that look with COVID-19? Would there be bowls, which we, all three of us, love dearly, and it's one of the highlights of our sports year, is to have the bowl season and watch all as many bowl games as possible. And so we wanted to have you on because I know there was a big decision made where now the number of wins, which normally would be a 500 season, they've taken that away, right? Where there it's allowed more teams to participate, and also I think it's great for obviously the cities that host the bowls. We didn't want them to be hurting as far as, or even more, not having the bowl with the economy.
Yeah, no, you hit some of the issues on the head. It was, you know, look, we're all going through a difficult year, you know, and I think the three of us will agree that you know, seeing college football games be played on Saturdays the last 6 weeks has been a very, very welcome sight. You know, I think, you know, there's a few games that get postponed every week. I think we'd have been naive to think that wouldn't happen, but I think for the most part we're moving forward. And, you know, we have 40 some odd bowl games across the country that work all year long, you know, to put on these events. They're community-based events. They mean a lot to their communities, and they mean a lot to the student athletes who have opportunities to participate. And so they've been working hard for months to find ways to be flexible, to make sure the bowl games can happen. And the conferences in turn have been, made it quite clear that they want those opportunities, especially in a year where they're not able to play 12 regular season games. You have such a discrepancy. Some leagues are playing 7, some 8, some 11, but nobody's playing 12. And that's really the point, kind of the tipping point as to why we made the decision to eliminate bowl eligibility requirements this year. I don't know how you even decide what bowl eligible is. If you're only playing 7 games, getting to 6 is unrealistic. If you're 3-4, you're obviously not 500, but you're shortchanged on the number of opportunities to get there. And all these student athletes have been through so much, they deserve the opportunity to play. And all these conferences have contracts in place. You know, the American that East Carolina is a member of has, you know, I think 7 or 8 contracts. So all this really does is allow every conference to fill their contracts. Each conference can decide on their own how they rank, you know, their teams. But we didn't want to have to worry about at the end of the year, is a team 3-4, are they 4-5, should they go to a bowl game, should they not? We're just taking all that mystery out, and we're providing another opportunity for these guys at the end of the year.
Nick, more than 40 bowl games, and just talk about how I know you have some that aren't on the mainland in terms of the Bahamas Bowl, the Hawaii Bowl. So which games are not going to be played this year?
Yep, so there's been 3 announced that will not be played. You mentioned 2 of them, Hawaii and Bahamas, and that's, you know, obviously it's COVID related, but it's also because of the challenges of traveling outside the mainland. So those are understandable. Game in San Francisco has been postponed to next year. They were undergoing a transition anyways. They're moving from the 49ers stadium back to the Giants baseball stadium, looking for a new title sponsor. And it's just hard to pull that together in this climate. They will be back stronger than ever in 2021. So we're not going to see those games this year. Where there may be 1 or 2 others that decide to take the year off, but I think we're going to see the majority of games be played this December and January.
So one question I had that came to mind, Nick, in the past, we'll get to your past in just a little bit, but the Pirates in the early 90s, for example, before all these bowl tie-ins, they had where the Peach Bowl picked East Carolina and NC State. Is this a situation that, my question will be, I know that you took away the number of wins. Will that be one of the factors for the bowls this year, is that they say, hey, East Carolina, say, is 3-6, but they travel well. They haven't been to a bowl in a number of years. We know they can sell out at this stadium very fast. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think the first part of your thought is accurate. I think the notion of regionality for maximizing attendance and fan travel, that may not be so big of a factor, because I think we all know it's still a mystery as to whether there's going to be any fans at all allowed at some of these games. And if there are, it would be minimal. But at the same time, keeping it regional is very important just for the travel, for the few fans that will be there, for the distance that the teams have to travel. And I think there may be an opportunity to see some old rivalries that have taken some time off to be rekindled in some of these bowl games. I think one of the most interesting things about the bowl season this year is the fact that there were virtually no non-conference games this year. Everybody's playing within conference. So the bowl season is really going to comprise the vast majority of non-conference games this year. So when you talk about bragging rights between conferences, it'll really, really come down to the bowl season.
You know, Nick, one of the things that comes to mind is East Carolina and Virginia Tech had a dispute a couple years ago because of the hurricane. I'm wondering if that would be a situation where they know that a lot of tickets will be sold. I think Virginia Tech is going to go to that probably won't be a reality. They're having such a great season, but that comes to mind. Is that something that I guess the Bulls would keep in mind, that would be a ticket that would be hard to get because people want to see that game?
Yeah, you know, I think, in terms of the how good of a season you have, historically there's been, bowl games at the higher end that get the teams with the higher records and it all sorts itself out. I think you're going to see, the placement of teams in bowl games. I think the selection order that these bowl games have typically had, the tradition of some of the games versus others, I think that might be a little bit secondary this year to geography and compelling matchups.
One of the big things with bowl games is obviously all the events that go in conjunction with the bowl game. With everything that's going on right now, I'm assuming that if not all of those things are probably not going to happen this year for obvious reasons. So what can you tell us and shed some light on in that regard?
Yeah, so we're, college football playoff, the semifinals and the championship game made this announcement already. I think unofficially the rest of the bowl system is going to follow suit, that these trips are going to basically be two-day trips. The teams are pretty much going to stay in their hotel. The bowl organizations will do the best job they can to give them some type of bowl experience. Typically part of that experience is enjoying the local flavor, the local food. You go to the Liberty Bowl in Memphis, you're going to have barbecue, et cetera. So I think they'll still try to do that. They'll bring it into the hotel. The student athletes will get their gifts and they'll play in a bowl game, which for a lot of these kids, it's going to be, the last opportunity they have to play football, to play a meaningful game with all their friends. The vast majority of Division I college football players do not play in the NFL. So this will still be a very, very special event, very special time for these student athletes.
And the food and the swag, those are the main things that the players would want anyway. So that's nice. That's one of the interesting things. I always love seeing what each bowl game provides its players in terms of the swag and so forth, depending on what that bowl game is, whether, the Belk Bowl, they got a big gift card to Belk, et cetera.
Yes. Yeah. That's what makes the bowl system great. Every bowl game's unique. If you're a student athlete and you can go to four different bowl games in your career, I think there'd be nothing better than, going to a different place each year, different part of the country. And, for a lot of these kids, it's their only opportunity to go to some of these cities and experience that culture. So it's pretty neat.
You're talking about the Liberty Bowl. I know the Pirates had it four different times, and you, Mr. Rosenbaum, you're talking to right now, his family. If it was on this is a compliment, Bubba, too, but if the bowl game was on the moon, the Rosenbaums would find a way to get there, right?
I love that.
Absolutely. Dave, but like you're saying, the 94, 95, and then 2008 and 2009 Liberty Bowls, we were there in Memphis, and you can tell that was a bowl game that was very established and is run in a first-class manner.
Yeah, they all the executive directors do a great job. I mean, Steve Earhart has been running the Liberty Bowl forever. He does a great job, and they all have their own personality, and they're all unique, and that's what makes it great. I think when, you know, people talk about the postseasons of different sports, they're all a little bit cookie cutter. And, you know, they all serve different purposes. You know, the bowl season, it's not a bracketed survive in advance type of postseason, but you really can't do that in college football. I mean, it's just, it would be too unwieldy. And let's face it, there's 130 FBS institutions. Only a handful could dream about playing in the 14 playoff, even if it goes to eight teams. So I think that the bowl season offers these schools that there's a bowl for everybody. There's a bowl that every program, no matter where they are in their stage of development, can aspire to get to at the end of the year.
You know, Nick, one of the things that we've talked about is the very fact with the Myrtle Beach Bowl coming up, and you have Coastal Carolina doing very well, a top 25 team now. Is it possible? Is it locked in as far as the bowl, as far as the tie-ins are concerned, with the way things are going with COVID? Or you're talking about travel, or is that something where, like Myrtle Beach, you could have Coastal Carolina, I guess East Carolina, like you're talking about the regionality and having some matchups people would care about?
Yeah, that's very possible. Yeah, I mean, like I said, every conference has their agreements with bowl games, but there are a handful of bowl games that kind of partner up, and they could trade off a little bit if it makes sense geographically and in terms of matchup. That particular matchup is not far-fetched at all.
That would be.
Go ahead, Dave. I'm sorry.
No, that would be great for a lot of Pirate fans because it's a short drive, Nick, from a lot of different geographic areas and metropolitan cities where the Pirates have a big alumni base. And who wouldn't want to go to Myrtle Beach in that time of year? That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Or any time for that matter.
Sign up now.
That's right.
And Nick, kind of working in reverse a bit, Dave kind of alluded to your background in athletics and all the things that you've done, and that we would be talking more about those later on. Take us back to the beginning of this year. I know you started the transitional role into your current position back in January, and then you took over full-time in April. What a crazy time to start a new job. So just talk about that and how this opportunity came about, and then we'll go into some of the other things you've done in the past.
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate to have this job. I honestly think I have one of the best jobs in sports. I mean, to oversee the bowl system, the tradition of bowl games goes back over 100 years. And to be able to kind of oversee the whole system and, advocate for all the great things that it does for so many people is just an awesome opportunity. Yeah, I don't know if this year, beginning of this year was a good time for anybody to start a new job. But it was a pretty easy transition for me simply because, I guess it's the same reason they hired me to do the job, whether it was my time at the Big East where I was negotiating bowl contracts with various bowl games. I was also on the NCAA Bowl Football Issues Committee, which was also the Bowl Certification Committee. So I developed relationships with every bowl game, literally. Obviously, when I was at Syracuse, I worked at Notre Dame as well. We went to bowl games. So, I had a unique understanding of the bowl system that most people just aren't ever in a position to have. So I was very fortunate to have those experiences. And I'm really, really blessed that they chose me to lead this group.
Talk about your time at the Big East. I know you stayed on during that transitional time when the Big East became the American. And so just talk about that decision to add the teams that you added, one of those, of course, being East Carolina when Terry Holland was athletic director. And just give us a glimpse behind the scenes and tell us some of the things that you can tell us as far as what made East Carolina and other schools so appealing.
Yep. Well, that was a crazy time in college athletics. It was one that I look back at fondly now. It was certainly a great experience professionally. I can't honestly say it's something I'd like to go through again. Having teams leave our league, and we had to, basically recreate the league. We were the Big East continued to exist under the name the American, and the Big East basketball schools that left technically were a brand new league, even though they took the name with them. So it was very odd. Terry did a great job advocating for East Carolina for years. He would be in constant contact, even when we were the old Big East, trying to find a way to join our league. And personally, we weighed a lot of options, all the institutions that there was no shortage of schools that wanted to join this new league that is the American. But in my, in my opinion, East Carolina kind of rose to the top. You know, you look at different factors. Some people look at marketplace. You know, you may not be in a big market, but there's a lot of big time college football programs that aren't in big markets. You know, it's more about your brand. It's about who cares about you. It's about your fan base. And the East Carolina fan base is very impressive. It always has been. And that was probably, I think East Carolina fans are probably the biggest reason that they had the opportunity to move into the American and participate in a league that I think is very underrated. I think it's an extraordinarily competitive football conference.
Yeah, that was something, East Carolina joining the Big East as it was for that short time period prior to becoming the American. That was a dream that had been 2+ decades in the making, going back to the early 90s. Virginia Tech back then got an invite as well as other programs, but East Carolina was left standing at the altar, so to speak, on the outside looking in, and remained an independent up through the 96 season prior to joining Conference USA from 97 up through 2013. When we got that invite, that was a huge moment for our university and its athletic program.
Mm-hmm. Well, we, you know, I told people all the time when we were debating East Carolina as a potential member, you know, I'd ask people, have you ever been to East Carolina? Have you ever been to a game? You know, not everybody has. You know, I experienced game day, you know, at East Carolina, and what a great atmosphere it is. And we were talking off camera a little bit. My very first experience working in sports when I was a graduate assistant at Syracuse University, our opening game was at East Carolina in 1992. Unfortunately for you guys, we went to the Fiesta Bowl that year. With that first play, Marvin Graves was the quarterback. Kadri Ismail motioned into the backfield, a triple option, tossed it to Kadri, and he took it to the house. So that was my first experience in the sports world, and I guess that's probably that one play probably solidified my career path.
Yeah, that game was like 42-21, I want to say, the final. It was a game, like you said, you guys jumped out right off the bat. I remember the Pirates scored late in the first half. And then, as Steve Logan is often known to do, that was his first year as head coach. And we would see this a lot over the next 11 seasons, surprise onside kicks and your trick plays, gadget plays, whatever you want to call them. And I remember right after halftime, he tried one of those surprise onsides and the Pirates are covering, and like you're thinking, hey, we just came off an 11-1 season. Can this happen again? Can we rally from 3 touchdowns down against an opponent like Syracuse? Obviously the answer was no, but those were tremendous teams with Paul Pasqualoni.
Yes. Yeah. Coach Pasqualoni did an unbelievable job up there. He'll go down as one of the more underappreciated college football coaches. He won 107 games at Syracuse, went to Fiesta Bowl, Orange Bowl, went to 9 bowl games, you know. Guess that wasn't good enough. I'm not sure they're doing too well right now. As much as I love Syracuse, they're my alma mater, but haven't been the same.
And Nick, you bring up a great point with the very fact of Syracuse being the Pirates play them. We actually need to rekindle that rivalry. I think it was a rivalry back in the day. I know we had a lot of independence, and I know there's the issue of scheduling with the ACC, and now there's an issue with COVID this year, and some people are saying maybe we should have, you know, 10 regular season games and 2 at large or whatever. But Syracuse and Pitt are 2 examples of, in my opinion, or teams that we should have back on the schedule for East Carolina. It's a great rivalry, and I think it'll be great for the newer Pirate fans to see as well.
I think you're right. You know, I don't have any stats in front of me, but it did seem like Syracuse and East Carolina played an awful lot back in the day.
Sure did. As far as now is concerned, there's Jay. Hey, Jay.
Hey, guys. How we doing?
Jay Sunhalter joins us now. Nick, I know you had a question for you. Jay, are you there? I guess he'll come back.
Yeah, hold on 1 sec, Dave. Hold on, Dave. 1 sec. I just have a computer glitch here.
Okay. All right, well, Nick, I'll ask you another one. As far as the bowl season, what are other things that the bowls can do? I know that something that has been talked about is using the bowls more for if they do expand playoffs. Is that something that your organization or the bowls would be in favor of, is to have more bowls doing to add to the college football playoff?
Absolutely. I mean, the bowl system is college football's postseason, and playoffs are a subset of that. You know, I remember when I was on the conference side at the Big East, you know, the commissioners of all 10 conferences, you know, really value the bowl system, you know, the entire bowl system. I mean, let's face it, the commissioner of the ACC does not just work for Clemson. He works for their full membership, right? So if there was only a playoff and no bowl games, a lot of them would not have any postseason options. So maintaining a relationship with bowl games, the bowl system, and the playoffs, I know is important to them, and I think it's important to the game of college football. So I expect that'll continue.
So we talked about your time, Nick, as an administrator at various universities. You also had the opportunity prior to moving into your current role to work for Under Armour and kind of see that side of the fence. So talk about your time working with that prominent company.
Yeah, so that was interesting. That was definitely a shifting of gears for me. And I worked for teams and leagues, and, you know, Under Armour approached me. They were looking to expand their college roster. And they hired me to head up college sports marketing and to go out and sign universities to outfitting deals. And that was a lot of fun. It was, you know, I had to learn that business, but certainly my relationships in college athletics are what served me well in that capacity. And, you know, we had great success. We signed, you know, right out of the chute, we signed Seton Hall and Cincinnati, and then we signed Wisconsin, Cal Berkeley, UCLA, which is the largest deal in the history of the NCAA. And those were interesting projects. I, like anything else at that level, it's super competitive. I mean, Nike and Adidas are really strong. So that was fun. I learned a lot. I learned the value of a brand, you know, and it's, you know, we talked about the pirate brand a little bit, you know, and the fan base and that logo and what it means for people when they see it. You know, same thing with Under Armour. You know, there's a reason people pay $20 for a t-shirt that has the Under Armour logo when they could buy one for $5 that has no logo on it. You know, it's a mental thing. It's a passion thing. And the study of brands is interesting to me.
I was waiting for Jay. I guess he's still having computer problems. We'll get to him in just a second.
Okay, I'm back.
Jay, this is being built up, buddy. This question you have for me, it better be.
This is a really big one. I got a lot of pressure on me. If it falls, just make it sound like it's a good one.
All right, I got you covered.
Okay, so with all the different backgrounds you've had, you know, whether it's, you know, with Under Armour, with college football, what's been the most, I guess, interesting or beneficial leader that you've taken from? Because you've been with a lot of different people. What's the biggest thing you've learned from someone, and who was that person?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been fortunate to have worked for a lot of amazing people. You know, some I have more respect for than others, just because I don't particularly have a lot of respect for them doesn't mean they weren't, that I didn't learn something from them. But, you know, Bill Belichick, I mean, it's kind of an easy one. You know, I feel very lucky that I was, you know, I was on his staff. He was my boss. So I was with him every day in staff meetings, team meetings, and, you know, everything you hear about him as a leader and his, you know, do your job, you know, mantra, if you will, it created such a great culture of winning, you know, and do your job is what you hear, but there's more to it. It's do your job well. It's do your job no matter how small it is. You know, if a team's going to be successful, whether it's a corporate team or an athletic team, you know, everybody has a role to play. You don't have to be a hero. You don't have to do something that's not your job. Sometimes sometimes that's detrimental if you step outside of your lane. But just do what you're supposed to do. Do it really, really well, and the team's going to be successful. And I've you hear it about him. I don't think you can fully grasp it unless you lived it. And I was very fortunate to be a part of that.
Nick, as far as your time now, what have you learned about the bowl system? I know you took over in the spring, and it's been an unbelievable year for everyone for different reasons, for COVID-19 and here in the year 2020. But what are you hearing from the folks of the bowls as far as the economy and that kind of thing, and what are they saying?
Yeah, well, they've been unbelievable. I mean, they've been very patient. You know, we're kind of the last in line. Like there'd be no bowl games if there was no regular season. You know, we were at the mercy of a lot of other people's decisions. So they did a great job of being patient, but at the same time, staying prepared and being as flexible as possible to shift dates, to shift the length of the bowl week, opponents, the bowl eligibility, all that stuff. And they're gonna put on a bowl game, you know, in each of their communities this year that's going to be as good as it can be. And in these trying times, those communities are really going to benefit from that. There's not a lot of, you know, I don't know how many fans are going to be able to go to these bowl games, but I guarantee it's a lot more people than are typically traveling into these various cities. So I think it's going to be a very welcome event in all of these communities as well as nationally. You know, people love turning on the TV between Christmas and New Year's and seeing what bowl game's on. They don't even know what bowl game's on. They just know one's going to be on, and they're surprised at which two teams it is, and they enjoy watching it. So we're lucky we're going to be able to have that this year, especially this year when it's been so difficult for everybody.
Like in a normal year, how many bowl games do you go to?
Well, this is my first year in this role. But, you know, when I was at the Big East, I would go to six or seven. When I was at Under Armour, we would follow our teams into bowl games, and it was probably five or six. I don't know how many I'll get to this year. We have this idea, and we think it'd be a pretty cool documentary where if we had a charter airline partner, we would take a camera crew, and I would go to every single bowl game, which logistically I might have to catch the kickoff of one game in one city and the tail end of another game in another city. But we think that'd be a kind of a cool journey and a cool thing to document. So someday, if there's 42 in that year, I'll get to all 42 of them.
All right, Nick, thank you so much. We appreciate you coming on, and love to have you back on during bowl season, because this has been a real interesting year, to say the least, and I would love to see how the bowls are going to be handling things, and obviously the different swag, and there's so much to talk about during the holiday season, and I'm just tickled to death that we're going to have the bowl season, and thanks for being a great guest, and love to have you back.
No, happy to be here. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Huge decision recently.
All right. Welcome back to the unofficial podcast of the Pirates. And we're back. Bubba and I are. And what a great interview. Thanks to Nick Carparelli, their executive director of the Bowl Association. And what a great guy. And we'll have him back on. A lot of fun with him. And hey, Bubba, how about how many guests have we had on that we had no idea they had ties to the Pirates, where he wasn't directly with the Pirates, but he had that 92 season where he saw how great the Pirates were that game day, and that helped him make a decision in 2014.
Yeah, and Nick was a tremendous guest. Really enjoyed talking to him. I tell you what, Dave, he's a guy that I definitely did not know about, not by a long shot, but it's just one of those things to show you just how many – great guests there are out there that we have not had on the program. And So just talking to Nick as far as his background, I mean, you saw Syracuse, Notre Dame, Under Armour. He's seen so much from so many different angles in the sports world. That's one of the things that I really enjoyed talking to him about. But you talk about that 1992 Syracuse team that he had the opportunity to be associated with as a GA. And he was talking about him winning the Fiesta Bowl. That was actually a little trivia. Up to that point in time, that was the largest crowd ever to see a game at Dowdy-Ficklin Stadium.
Wow.
Because it was 36,500 the previous year against Pittsburgh. We had 36,000 where we brought in some temporary bleachers. And then what is now the Boneyard end zone. But that season opener in 92, we had 36,500 for Syracuse.
And that's awesome, because 2 months later, not that it really mattered, or not even that long, I found out October of 92, a month later, actually, a month and a half later, whatever, that I would be, I was accepted in East Carolina in October of that year. And very exciting times as I found out that I would be a Pirate and a school that I wanted to go to, and made it in. So 92 is a very special year for me as I started my Pirate journey, and I've never looked back. And obviously I was a big fan, as you know, Bubba, not as early as you were, but I started in 1986. So like 5 years after you became a Pirate, I knew you were born into Pirate Nation. So some of us traveled to Eastern North Carolina and became a Pirate. And I guess we all have become Pirates in different ways. We got a lot of great guests coming up over the next few weeks. We got Bubba, Kyle, and I have been working really hard behind the scenes. We don't have time to talk about that tonight, but we'll let folks know to thank you for all the support over the last 2.5 years. We're working hard, always evolving. We want to thank David Glenn, Nick Harparelli, and Bubba. Tomorrow night, we've got another great show.
Yeah, the Inside Slant. This afternoon, we recorded an interview with Rich Phillips, SMU's play-by-play voice. We've had Rich on the show multiple times before, but you have number 16 SMU hosting ninth-ranked Cincinnati. Will be a tremendous game this weekend, 9 p.m. I want to say it's ESPN2 at Ford Stadium there in Dallas. So really looking forward to taking that one in. You're also going to hear from Corey Smith of Pack Pride about the matchup of ranked teams that you discussed with DG earlier. As you have NC State traveling to Keenan Stadium to take on the Tar Heels. We'll also have a first-time guest from the Casper Star Journal and Pokes Authority, Wyoming's beat writer. The Mountain West is obviously beginning play this week, as is the Big Ten, and Davis Potter. To talk about the Cowboys and their trip to Nevada. And then we'll also catch up with Ohio State's beat writer with the Columbus Dispatch, as the Buckeyes will be welcoming Scott Frost and the Nebraska Cornhuskers to the Horseshoe on Saturday.
It's going to be great. Cannot wait. Bubba, with the Pirates off, we get a chance to be college football fans and watch a lot of football. I'm so excited this weekend. I get to watch football, and more football as I get college and pro. I'm so excited on my big screen and can't wait for the Pirates next week. We'll have a lot of course, with the big game at Tulsa, we'll have a lot of different shows and obviously the coaches' press conferences and those things next week. All right. Appreciate David Glenn for all his hard work. And obviously I know whatever he does next, it'll be great in the sports world with media, whatever that looks like. Want to thank, obviously, just had him on, Nick Carparelli from earlier this afternoon with the executive director of the Bowl Association. Want to thank Kyle from LaGrange Barber. Bubba, man, I appreciate you. You're my brother from a different mother. You and Kyle, brothers from a different mother. And I appreciate you both for your hard work. And Bubba, thanks so much for all your stuff behind the scene. Means a lot. And we look forward to tomorrow night. All right, that's going to be the Inside Slant tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, like we just said. You've been watching the Sports Objective and listening to the Sports Objective right here. And we appreciate it. Good night, everybody, and go Pirates!